John Daly here. You know what day it is? Neither do I. I live life daily. That's why I only spin on Moto Casino. Moto's got daily free bonuses, daily tournaments, new slots added daily, and the best part? Guaranteed daily jackpots. You can't beat that. So today's the day you grip it and spin it with me on Moto, America's social casino. Play for free on Moto.us.
Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details. Download the Moto Casino app today. Must be 21 plus.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
Now then, just a quick announcement before the episode begins, as this episode comes out on the 2nd of March 2026. That means tomorrow the podcast is three. It's little third birthday. Oh my God, that's amazing. Threenager. Is that what the podcast is? Having little tantrums here and there? No, probably not. If you want to give the podcast a birthday present, do feel free to leave me a review or share a post or anything like that. That would be amazing. Anyway, I forgot to add it in the main episode, so I thought I'd just plonk it here. So, happy birthday to the Bell Witch podcast. Now then, witches and beautiful souls, welcome back to another fantastic episode of the Bell Witch Podcast with Swales, the Friendly Green Witch, up in West Yorkshire. And today is another delightful Moot Loot episode with a lovely guest, Ben, who has written a couple of books now on witchcraft, relationships with deities and Welsh folklore and all that lovely magic. I interviewed them back in October around spooky season and then promptly lost the recording and I've been trying to find it ever since. Turns out it's on Riverside, so here we are. Honestly, what am I like? It's great timing though, as they talk about how the landscape influences us and things like that. I have just been on my annual gallivanting to Baytown or Robin Hood's Bay, as the tourists know it, with the two witchlings and 30 plus other amazing magical souls. I introduced the therapy of junk journaling while I was there and I shared some of my poetry as well, which was very nerve-wracking. I do find it quite hard to stand up in front of people and speak publicly, but I did it. The landscape really does have its own soul, its own spiritual vibration, and it's caked in folklore. Of course, we did the ghost walk again, the folklore ghosty walk with Rose of Whitby Ghost Tours. And you can hear about my first ever visit to Robin Hood's Bay, which was 3 years ago now. I got two episodes out of that. The Magic of the Sea and Witches, Ghosts and Folklore from the Coast, which I shall link in the episode description below. But yes, it was another successful visit and it was perfect timing because I have been hibernating deep this winter and kind of refusing to come out of my hole. The dates that Robin Hood's Bay falls on is the end of the winter, beginning of the spring, just after Imhoff. It's fantastic timing because it makes me get out there and be with people and socialise. Right now, my socialising battery is very low, but I'm recovering fast because today and the last few days of February, the sun was so shiny. I was like, where have you been? I've really missed you. And of course, we are officially in the year of the fire horse. Isn't it interesting that mid bread bake, my oven broke? I was absolutely gutted and not sure what to do with this half-baked loaf. Turned out to be gross anyway, but I find it so uncanny that the first thing to break in the year of the fire horse is my oven. And in Feng Shui, the oven is like the centre of your family home, and it's fire element, so it's passionate and it's active. I can't believe it happened. It's like, talk about the house giving me a message. I did mean to clean the oven any time now, so at least I don't have that job to do anymore, eh? The year of the fire horse has come galloping our way. It is the beginning of the end of a turbulent year. Now that the snake has truly shedded and buggered off, it's nice to have a new positive galloping energy, and is the seventh animal in a 12-year cycle of the Chinese zodiac. Coming after the shedding snake and before the wise goat, recent years of the horse include 2014, 2002, 1990, 1978, 1966, and 1954. And the next horse year is in 2038, which will be the Earth horse. So a lot more grounded and slower. This horse gallops with unapologetic fire energy every 60 years. It is of high, rapid change energy and rejects old systems with its fiery independence, and the element fuels the passion and confidence to jump over obstacles and kick them on the way down. Yes, it is a fast energy, a doing energy, a masculine energy that can sometimes get the horse into trouble, but it's nothing it can't handle. This is a time for social change, setting boundaries, protesting about the things we disagree with, making a stand for the things we believe in, which is just what happened 60 years ago, which saw the Cultural Revolution in China in 1966. So this is a time for taking action, leaps of faith, crushing habits that no longer serve. Feelings of courage and determination will burn through those moments of uncertainty if you choose to connect with the horse. Bold, fast and independent decisions will make you stronger and move forward fast in your plans. But remember, balance is key, as the horse is subject to charging into things a bit like a bull in a china shop. It is important to keep mindful and not get too swept away in the moment of the fire element. As faster the flame burns, the quicker the spark burns out. The horse can be too self-absorbed and a tad overconfident, and that's when it'll miss the gate, jumping over the fence and perhaps making more work for itself than necessary. But it'll love the thrill. Remember, work smarter, not harder. The horse will be tempted to refuse help, feeling so confident that it'll think it unnecessary. But we all need help at times, and it is important that we ask for it and accept it when it is offered from the heart. It does remind me a little bit of the Leo zodiac sign with all its fire energy. It's lovely, and it is so what is needed right now for great changes afoot. Over breakfast one morning, I was telling my little witchlings about this horse, or os, as we say up in West Yorkshire. Flossie pointed out it was a dragon, a snake and a horse in that order. And I said, yeah. And she said, ooh, isn't that interesting? Because Clem loves dragons, you love snakes, and I love horses. So it's like all three of us stood together. I love pagan kids. Just before I go, I want to thank my lovely Patreons for joining. Sam Farah and Catherine Edwards, who have joined the Patreon as a paid member. Thank you so much for supporting me. It means a great deal. There's a lot on there now. I'm quite proud of my Patreon. There's nearly 170 posts. And the recent one is the video from the last episode. The Dark Atlas Tours is a fantastic video. And there's also a little bit of this blurb on the horse, plus a bit more insights. So do come over and have a little nosy and do the 7-day trial. See what you think. And if you like it, you might join it. Don't worry if you can't. But if you do, I'd be right buzzing me. I'd be right buzzing. Enjoy this interview from October with the lovely Benjamin, who wrote a recent book called The Dove and Raven. And go buy the books, not from Amazon, from somewhere else. Or maybe get the book from your local library. Okay, love you. Bye. With me today, I have Ben Stimpson, who's an author and a podcaster and a mental health therapist and all kinds of things. I've got a massive array of
things.
So welcome. It's lovely to have you. Can you tell us a little bit about your background and what kind of witch you are, if you are one?
Yeah, so my background is I'm from North Wales myself. So I'm based down in Northamptonshire right now, but mum and dad are from the North, from Manchester and Yorkshire respectively. And I spent 30 years of my life in Canada. So I just moved back about 6 months ago to the UK, fulfilling a lifelong dream to come back. And it's hard to say what kind of witch I am because it's so integrated. Like, I have got fingers in a lot of pies. A lot of my work is with ancestor work and spirit work. So spirit work tends to be a big part of my practice, but I'm starting to really reconnect with the folkloric roots, right? Get my hands dirty, get back into crafting and doing things again. So now I'm back in kind of the area that I come from. It's working with the plants of our shared folklore and working with the landscape. Yeah, I don't know how to answer that question. Sorry, I'm just a witch.
I'm a bit of one of those witches as well, which pulls bits and bobs from here and there. But it is about following your instincts, isn't it? And your intuition.
Yeah. Little nudges. I work a lot with weird. And so, like, literally have it tattooed onto my body. So I tend to do a lot of weird working, becoming conscious of those little connections and what little strings I can pull and manipulate. So that tends to be a big part of my practice too.
What's weird?
Weird is the Scandinavian Germanic concept of fate. And unlike this kind of Judeo-Christian or classical concept of fate, where you have the three sisters who are constantly on top of everything and affecting the world, the Germanic concept of fate is unraveling all the time. So if you look at, like, the Icelandic sagas, for example, so in Scandinavia, it's Urd, whereas in Germanic and Anglo-Saxon, it's Weird. And it's this idea of the tapestry constantly being woven in the moment. So we might have an idea of what the pattern will look like in the future, but we don't know all of the steps to it. There's also this sense that destiny is not necessarily predetermined. What we do now will affect that destiny in the future. Even if we have a sense of what the bigger destiny, the vague destiny is, every step along the way contributes. Every shred of the tapestry creates that image, and we can add new things to that to create smaller images along our way. So it really is a sense of an unfolding, and which I find a lot more empowering. There's no one central deity that is controlling everything. There's a sense of responsibility there too. There's also a sense of understanding that sometimes we're just caught in an eddy that began before we even arrived. Somehow we got caught up in that eddy and we're just going to have to go along with it. How we react and respond to what's happening in the present is what would be classed as heroic in that system, versus putting up our hands saying, it's in the hands of fate now. Well, no. Fate is our hand.
Oh my God, I can't believe I've not huge. Come across that before, because it does make sense. I do have issues with the whole, like, we're on a journey and we can't have a say in what happens, because you're always making decisions, aren't you?
All the time. And so when you look at, like, the Icelandic sagas, for example, this idea of premonitions come up a lot, because there's one scene in one particular famous saga where a soldier has just killed one of the main characters or one of the main people, and the wife of that individual comes out and she's holding a shawl, and he gets a premonition that at the end of the shawl, because there's blood, the person he's just killed, his blood is at the end of the shawl. He says, my death is at the end of that shawl. And go figure, later on, the wife who's pregnant with the son of the character who's been killed, she swaddles him in that shawl and shows him that shawl and says, this is the blood of your father. And so literally at the end of that shawl is his own death, because that son grows up and then goes and causes and takes revenge. Yeah, it's huge. Yeah, it's big. Yeah, it's big. So becoming aware of premonitions.
Yeah, totally. Now I'm gonna write that down. I'm gonna look that up, because I cannot believe I've got to this age and not known about it. What?
And you're so close to York. Come on.
Yeah, I know. But I don't very much leave Leeds. I'm very much stuck in my ways.
It's a beautiful city, honestly.
Yorkshire girl. You mentioned you lived in Canada for 30 years. How has it been a witch over there? Are they quite open-minded?
I would say so, yeah. Where I was at was about 2 hours from Toronto, and the local pagan scene in Ontario is very connected to the East Coast pagan scene. So trying to think, there's a huge festival in Pennsylvania, it's or upstate New York. It's one of the most famous. All of the major people and elders from the pagan scene over there used to go there. They'd been going to, since the 80s, and although it's a massive continent, it really is a huge continent. A lot of people are really connected. They tend to travel a lot. A lot of the authors over there tend to travel a lot. And so they're a lot more integrated than the UK, where, like you, people don't tend to move from where they are. It's always been fascinating to me when I say, oh, you're over in Manchester. Do you know this so-and-so in Chester? No, never met them before. It's not even 45 minutes. What do you mean?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's fascinating. Like over here, right, we've got a very strong north-south divide, right? A lot of the events in the south don't tend to integrate really with the events up in the north there. And so you have writers who, you know, they're writing on the same topics and they may only see each other at one conference in Glastonbury every year and that's it. Whereas in North America, people are moving around. There's a lot more connection. There's a bigger online space. And a lot of the elders grew up together. There's a lot of connections there. But it's a different system because obviously we're settlers in a settled land, in a colonized land. There is always that discrepancy with cultural appropriation of how much can we really connect with this landscape, knowing that our ancestors came here and we're settlers on this landscape. It's a different thing. And yet, that being said, there are traditions like Appalachian folk magic, Southern conjure, hoodoo, a lot of Celtic, Scots-Irish granny magic, a lot of traditions that came from Europe and have survived for 300 years, whereas they may have died out in the old world. So it's a very, very different, although familiar form of magic and being a witch over there. People are really refinding themselves. Yeah.
Did you find yourself wanting to come back to Blighty? Was there a pull to come back to, like, your motherland? Did you feel it?
Yeah, very much so. Very early on, so neurodivergent. I'm also gay, I'm queer, and I've since come out as non-binary. There's a lot of things that make me different than a lot of people I grew up with. I explain this to people and they always get it. I wasn't British or Welsh until I moved to Canada. Culture shock for me was such a huge thing. And one of the ways that I dealt with that I was 8 years old when I left. It would have been maybe less cruel if I had been younger and didn't have strong memories of this place, but I did. And one of the ways that I really connected was through TV shows, like anything to do with King Arthur, Robin Hood, any of the stories from over here. And of course, like in the 90s, so many of the TV shows for kids were based on British folklore and on all that, right? So I really connected with the folklore as a way of salving that sense of home. That's how I got into magic. I watched The Mists of Avalon and I was like, wait, we can do this? What? And 2001, I started practicing. And so then that became like as part of a spiritual practice for me. It also fit with where I came from. It was a sense of identity for me. So I've always wanted to come back. And things are getting worse in Ontario. So I was like, why not? So I started working towards it. Luckily, my professional stuff transferred. And so I started building a UK client base. And here I am now, 6 months being in the UK. And I'm not even sure how that's gone, but it's been perfect.
Lovely to hear that you found who you are and grounded in your identity and stuff. It's lovely, is that? While you were there, you mentioned you were writing this book, which is the main reason you're on The Bell Witch, because you want to tell us this gorgeous book. It's beautiful.
Isn't
looking.
Isn't it beautiful? Yeah, really pleased. And it's called Of Doves and Ravens, The Witches and Wise Folk of Wales and the Borders.
Is there a story behind the name? I was reading, I was pondering this.
So I started writing this originally for a different publisher, and my relationship with that publisher fell through. I wasn't really interested in working with him anymore. And so originally it was a full volume for Wales, Scotland, and England. And I had enough material I could separate it out, because what I noticed was in the diaspora, there was a lot of ideas about what traditional witchcraft and the folklore of witchcraft was. And when you actually go into our sources of folklore, quite a lot of it is either made up or it's not kosher or it's not really traditional. You get those elements, definitely, but it's not traditional. So people are creating practices out of this folklore that isn't traditional. And it's not even traditional to the folklore that came over and was implanted over there. So I thought, you know what? let's start to put this together. So I started putting it together, wrote it together. And so originally I called it Wise Ones, and it was all of the countries. When I ended up approaching History Press, I separated it all out. And originally this was going to be called Saints and Sinners, because the culture of Wales is so embedded with Christianity. Christianity of Wales really goes back to the Roman period. It wasn't like the Saxons who had to be converted and then they formed their own form of Christianity. And then I sat with it, and as I started looking at the motifs, there's a very particular Welsh motif, and it's concerning legendary magicians. We're thinking like Michael Scottus, we're thinking of Friar Bungay, we're thinking of like Friar Bacon, right? Johann Faustus, those sorts of stories. And in Wales in particular, there's one very specific story where when the magician is coming to the end of his life, he tells his family to take out his innards, his lungs, his heart, different versions in different stories. And the story is applied to 15 of these different magicians. It's a widespread motif. And he says, I want you to watch to see if a dove or a raven comes. And if a dove comes to eat of my offal, then it means I've gone to heaven. If a raven comes, it means I've gone to hell. And just that image there, the dove and the raven, was just, oh, I just couldn't get it out of my head. So I changed the title to that. And then Ellie, who was the editor I worked with, also happens to be the artist. And I didn't know this until much later. And she came up with this beautiful image.
Oh, it's gorgeous.
A Welsh witch. Yeah, I was really pleased. And to be fair, like, I know you just had the Three Ravens podcast on. There was some real debate about whether or not I could call it this, because their book was coming out around the same time, and it may cause confusion. So they went to bat for me, or the editor went to bat for me. And so Of Doves and Ravens it is.
Yeah, no, I love it. It's a good name. And I must admit, like, as a witch buying a book, I would definitely buy a book called Doves and Ravens, and not so much Saints and Sinners, because that's a little bit like,
I know,
churchy.
Right?
Yeah. It makes me go, so it was a good move. Good move. And I knew there'd be a good story about it, because it's such a wonderful name. It must take a long time to create this book, because I had a read and it is so full to the brim of magnificent stories.
The process to write it, once I pinned down how to, and I also, transparency here, I also have an academic background in medieval history and classical history, and that's only from a few years ago. So I know how to do research, I know how to work with research materials. And so my process with this was to basically collect as many of the folklore, like written materials that I could, and lay them out from oldest to newest, and then go through, because what you can do is you can go through and find key terms. You could find the original versions of story and then follow that through the telling in order to see how the story changes and evolves. And so that's how I've written this book, is by showcasing all of those different, or as many of those different editions that I can, to show how the stories that we take for granted if we just open a regular folklore book, how that has been affected by retellings. And it's been very effective in learning how not only stories evolve and grow, but also how in each century, because we're really looking at the 1700s to like the end or the beginning of the 20th century, a lot of these stories have been found through that, quickly they evolve, why they evolve, and what really is big in these stories. So that's cool. It was a cool process to do, but it took about 4 months of every single day. Luckily it was like middle of winter, I didn't have that many clients at the time, and I was staying in my parents' house, so I could just focus on that. And so it was a boon.
Did you find, like, what influenced how a story is retold? Is it a case of how it's recorded? Did you see patterns while you were doing it?
Absolutely. This is true for England and Scotland as well, but for Wales in particular, you're looking at each century, right? So you have to look at the different sources. Some of the juiciest gossipy stories that I could find were actually from gentlemen's magazines, like the tabloids of their day. It's juicy. I'll give you a very good example, right? So Mary Bateman, you know, the Witch of Leeds, hometown girl. She has a book written about her that came out after her case had concluded. And when you really look at it, it is just tabloid, right? And I think it's the rueful tale of Mary Bateman, evil Mary Bateman and her ex, right? And you look at that, and that is actually where a lot of the mythology of Mary Bateman comes from. But when you actually look at court records, a lot of those details are not in there. But that's what sticks in the mind. So with this, you've got those gentlemen's almanacs. You've got then folklorists, antiquarians, things. You've got those nationalists who are going out there to find these stories because they are important for national identity. You've also got reverends going around. So you've got churchmen who are going out there, again, for a very similar purpose. One of the most famous collectors was Dr. Elias Owen, and he was such a remarkable man. He was a reverend in the Church of England. Church of England? Or Methodist? He was either Methodist or Church of England. But whenever he went to another reverend, because he was like traveling around, he would ask them what some of the local folklore was, and he'd collect it and write it down. So a lot of the stories that we take for granted nowadays wouldn't have been preserved if he hadn't done that. But you also had those reverends who were going around because they were anti-superstition. They wanted to stamp it out. So what would they do? They would write a huge, big, long tract detailing every single thing about that particular superstition or story or folklore and print it. And then with the caveat, well, this is evil. We shouldn't be believing in this. Yeah. Ironically, preserving it for the future.
Everybody's got that angle.
Everybody has their angle. And this is important because when you start to look at multiple sources, when you start to see multiple versions of the same story, those angles really come through. So like Mary Trevelyan, who is a travel writer from the late 1800s, early 1900s, she's very well known because her book happens to be very available on places like sacredtext.org or online, right? She was writing as a travel writer in order to get people to come. So when you look at her versions, they have details that don't exist in any of the other versions. They make for compelling stories, but they're not quite kosher. And yet, that being said, she also wrote down stories that nobody else wrote down. So we have to be careful with those stories. But because they've just been accepted as lore, they've just become part of folklore. I caught her out once. If I didn't do this project for England, Wales, and Scotland all at the same time, I wouldn't have noticed this. There's a particular witch that she's written about in Southern Down, which is down just south of Cardiff. And the naughty woman, she naughty, she had lifted and plagiarized that exact story, just changed the names and spaces. She was writing in the 1890s. She had taken that from Horne's Table Book, and the original witch was a witch named Bertha up in the North Dales there. Exact same text from 40 years before, and it was based in Yorkshire. And I'm like, oh, Mary Trevelyan, what are you doing here?
Can't get it past
but
me.
But it was a compelling story. But of course, plagiarism was a big thing in the Victorian age because, you know, a lot of people, like there was no such thing as copyright back then. So people were doing it all the time.
And people just wrote what they wanted. There were no fact checking.
And this is why going back and looking at as many sources as we can. Exactly. Yeah. But again, folklore is perpetual. Folklore is perennial. Some of the older characters in the pubs would have been doing the same thing to get a laugh and a pint.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. What I love about your book as well is that you've set it out in a really helpful way. Some stories are quite small and you can dip in and out, and some are a few pages. And the map, I love the map because that helps you.
I know.
Recognize where everything is and like visualize, and there's pictures in it and stuff. Like, as a dyslexic person, these things really help.
I wish that I could say and lay claim to that, but that is actually me following other folklorists' way of doing it. There's some beautiful, here we go. People are going to know this book as soon as I show it. Jennifer Westwood's Albion.
Oh, yes.
There we go.
Yeah.
It's essentially the same way, right? She has listed these stories in where they come from and also have maps so that you can actually go and visit. What I did differently with this is instead of saying, I don't know, like Rotherham, there was a story about a giant bar. I've actually laid this out by the individual practitioner, which is really important because people are wanting to know about the individuals. There's like three core ingredients to a memorable story, especially for those of us who are neurodivergent, right? Place, name, and story. Place the story, it becomes a lot more memorable. And if we've got a really vivid idea of the character, it becomes a lot more memorable even more. And then you've got all three elements there, and you can actually go to these places and see these places and almost experience the presence of those individuals.
Yeah, no, I love that. It does help me a lot. One of the stories that sticks in my mind, I've wrote it down. Where is it now? Where is it? Somebody rescued a witch from drowning and she gave the rescuer a ball that had snake skin in it. Do you remember which one?
Yes, it's the one up in Malwyn. It's the one up in Anglesey. And he went down, he saw her drowning, and he went down to get her out and came out. And that ball is allegedly still in the family somewhere. It was supposed to have gone down to Australia, I believe. And it was that sense of the witch's ball protection, right? That one's one of Mary Trevelyan's.
Oh, God.
Yeah, I know, right? This is where it's... Yeah, I know, right? And yet, that being said, this idea of miracle balls is a motif in other parts. So there's another character... I say character, but many of them are semi-legendary, semi-historical. There is another individual from Mid Wales called Old Griff. And Old Griff lived in the 1950s, 1940s. And he was visited by a woman who wrote a book on him and his miracle ball. He had a miracle ball that was almost like some kind of a crystalline ball. And he would use this for healing. Now, of course, this is way past the actual cunning folk in hospice age. She was a spiritualist herself, so there was also that sense of crystal healing in that. And yet balls are a motif. Witches' balls are all over the place. So it's okay, yeah, even if it's not kosher, there may have been something there originally. But it's a good story too. And when you go to the Cromlech, the standing stones overlooking that bay, stand where he's supposed to have stood, you could almost imagine looking down and seeing this woman praying about in the water.
Yeah. And I love that it was, yeah. I think you said it was 40 years ago it were last registered where it was. So that really enchanted me. Like, oh, that's not long ago,
yeah,
is it?
I wonder where, yeah.
Where is it now?
And when you look at it, we've got, I think a lot of people, especially North Americans, tend to think of witch lore and witches as being centuries ago, like the 1600s during the witchcraft trials. But we have those stories all the way through. Good example of this is Lizzie Beatty, the Brampton witch, and she lived in late 1800s, like 1890s is when she's supposed to have passed away. But she had a tea set that she gave to her, I can't think who he is now, but he was like her steward or he was a caretaker or something like that. And she gave this tea set and said, this tea set has to be like, keep this in the family because it will protect you. And so it's been passed down through the family. And now it's somewhere in, I want to say somebody in Carlisle has it right now. There was a news report written about it a few years ago. And that's only 100 years ago. But she was like full on, like she had glasses that she would use as her peepstones, these scrying glasses. And she had her playing cards that she would be doing divination with, and people would give her things because they obviously didn't want to get her wrath. So it's very close to our modern time. It is.
Mm-hmm. Enchanted tea set?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, an enchanted tea, yeah. Yeah, Lizzie Beatty of Brampton, yes.
Do you have a favourite witch that sticks in your mind that you can tell us listeners about?
Yeah, so one of my favourites, and I dedicated the book to her, is a woman, and she's a historical din hospice, so a historical fortune teller from North Wales, Denby. So I come from very close to Denby, and her name was Bella Fowler, Big Bella. And we know that she was a historical individual because a travel writer actually met her and did a little piece of her in 1802, 1803. And she would basically go around the markets of North Wales and she would be doing fortunes for people. She would be doing astrology sometimes. And she reminds me, like the way she would talk in this little description, she reminds me of some of the people I know, right? Some people we know. So she's really cool. What happened with her, though, after she died, because she was so well-loved, is then the legend started. And by 50 years, 60 years after her death, suddenly she was not just a fortune teller that was going from marketplace to marketplace, she was suddenly part of the Llandona witches, so the witches of Anglesey, and she was their leader, or she was like really connected in, and the stories in the 20th century of her being cannibalistic, that she would kill children. So that's how quickly the legends grow. But just because she's so close to where I come from and she's a hometown girl, she's very special to me. Yeah, I love her. And I want, if there is a gravesite, I want to track down her gravesite, because I know it's somewhere in, I want to say it's St. Asaph or somewhere like that, and I want to go and lay flowers at her grave.
Oh,
or like vaguely, yeah.
Yeah,
because I think that would be nice.
She'll have a gravestone then, will she?
Oh yeah, I should hope so. This is where you can really get the both gendered and the class distinctions in these stories, because you really get that sense of that idea of the little old witch at the edge of a village being poor. That definitely comes through in the folklore, and that definitely comes through in the history too. I think we can appreciate that in the 20th century, 21st century, because how many people we know who are of lower income who live maybe in council housing or on housing estates that are doing tarot readings in order to generate some money too. I definitely know people like that. That's what makes the folklore really real to me, because it mirrors modern life.
And this is a bit of a geeky question, but because
okay.
Whales and dragons are like
yes.
obviously close knit. Is there any dragons in your book or any dragon-inspired stories? There's none.
Nope. This is what's surprising, right? A lot of North Americans have asked me the same question. Of course, the dragon is really a big symbol for Wales, but it's a very ancient one, right? It really comes from that era of like Arthurian tradition and like Mabinogi, right? Whereas a lot of the stories in this book are really only from the past 400 years, 500 years, right? And so I think there might be one story where snakes appear, but the majority, yeah, dragons don't appear. It's an interesting thing. It really shows the multidimensionality of this tradition. Yeah, I'm sure a lot of the people in this would have been called dragons in their local communities. But
all dragons. You know,
all dragons.
Does surprise me that, actually, yeah. Hey, what are you doing right now? Besides listening to a rather awesome podcast, might I add? Well, while you're here, do you fancy just opening up the app in which you're listening to this podcast on and putting some stars in for that little podcast which is independently made with no backing or large funding bodies? Perhaps writing a quick review saying, "This is awesome!" Blush. In all honesty, those stars mean a lot to podcasters like myself. And they really do help us to grow and increase our reach as a podcast episode. It is a labour of love. And we all are addicted to creating content for you right now to enjoy and be thoroughly entertained. It's magic, as those stars really do help the show to shine. So if you don't mind and your thumbs are not too tired, please leave a rating and review. You legend. Okay, thanks for that. I shall leave you be to enjoy the episode. Wales is very witchy historically. I wonder why that is. Is it to do with the hills and the mountains? Because it's very like organic and natural surroundings. Do you think there's, I don't know what I'm trying to ask, something about the landscape of Wales?
If I get your question correctly, there's two pieces. One, I would say, when you look at the stories in this, a lot of them are very similar to the stories of witches in Scotland and Wales. And when you look at, like, when the two sequels of this eventually come out next year sometime, you can see that there are as many stories, different motifs, but like every village has it had its own cunning man or cunning woman, wise people, and witches, right? What's really important with Wales is the understanding that magic was not seen in the same way in Wales as it was in England. In England and Scotland, the idea of a witch was, especially coming from the trials, was that they were unhuman, they were demonic by nature, they were no longer human. In Wales, however, the idea of a witch, even the word witch, was imported from English. The idea with magic in Wales was what you did, but it didn't determine who you were. So you had dinhuspis, the knowing ones. These are the cunning folk and cunning women who would be going around healing, charming. They would be using their astrology to find lost things, but they would also be cursing as well. And that wasn't necessarily seen negatively, because it was how you used those curses. Magic was something everybody did in Wales, in the same way that it was in England and Scotland, but the laws were different. And so there were only actually 5 witch trials in all of Welsh history, as opposed to the 400, 500 in English history. And it surprises people. People are like, no, they were being burned all over the place. That's not actually true.
I think that's my favourite fact, that only a handful of lovely witches were getting hurt in Wales.
Yeah. And most of them didn't, like, most of them were not killed or hung for it. They were tried, but they weren't killed. A lot of them were acquitted. And of the 5 that I, like, have been, again, documented, and that doesn't mean that there weren't more after that, there's one story where it may have been that the town took justice into their own ways, but there's no physical evidence. It's just a story, right? But magic was seen as a resource. What was more important for the communities there, because they're isolated, they're in the valleys, they're up in the hills, right? They're up in the mountains, was actually about thieving, right? They wanted to stop thieves from going and stealing. These are very tight-knit communities. Oftentimes, they were all related to each other in some way. So if you have a thief going around stealing things, that's going to destroy social cohesion a lot more, much more damaging than if one woman may have witched the butter of somebody else and or stole milk or whatever it was. Theft was much bigger. And we can see this reflected in the laws. Welsh law, up until England imposed their own laws, was much more on theft and quite severe for theft. Witchcraft, not so much. So it surprises people. But that, I think, speaks to the lack of understanding of Wales as a culture in history.
Is there any specifically Welsh magic folklore tradition that you see today that you know is from all the history that you've been looking at?
This is the thing. Being away from Wales for 30 years, I've been back and visited, obviously, but I haven't been embedded. There is a great deal of interest right now for, like, in Druidry, for example, a lot of interest in, like, the old Welsh englands, and the englands are, like, the rhyming poetry that are also used for charms. That's part of the Eisteddfod tradition. So the Eisteddfod tradition is the Welsh national cultural event of Welsh language, and you see them all over the place. There's the national Eisteddfod, which kind of goes from place to place. Then you've got the regional, and a lot of Welsh-speaking kids will have grown up in that world, and a lot of magic is coming from that. Mara Starling is a really good example of this, right? And her book, when you look at her books, and I know Mara, and if Mara's listening to this, smack me later on if I get this wrong, Mara. But a lot of her stuff is about teasing out and refinding and bringing and representing, right, a vision of what Welsh witchcraft could be. We know that charming has continued, and there are traditional charmers still about. There's a lot of people who are still trying to refine it, and that's what this book is really for. This book is to bring together all of these sources, because a lot of the folklore also documented authentic Welsh recipes and spells and charms, particularly using things like the Bible, for example, or the Bible is a magic book. And that has continued, but I don't know if people would look at that and be like, oh, that's witchcraft, or oh, that's magic. In the same way, like, I've been part of the Cuban Lucumi Santeria tradition, in the same way that, like, an old school Cuban abuela grandmother would say, no, I'm a good Catholic. Okay, well, what's the egg doing at the doorways to clean people off? Well, cognitive dissonance is a thing. So it does exist. There is also a history, too. So one of the most famous cunning men of Wales was a man called Dr. John Harris, and he formed a dynasty of cunning folk. So these are people, like the people in the community you'd come to if you needed astrology done, if you wanted to have a charm written to stop witches from attacking your kids, whatever, right? If you lost something, you would go and they would do divination. And his house is still there. He still has relatives who know that he was in their family tree in the area of Carmarthen in Pantycoy. People can actually go there, and up until the late 1890s, one of his great-granddaughters still lived in the house. So that history is still there and is still part of the folklore. Whether people practice it, probably do. And my friend Brett Holyhead, he said that he met an actual authentic Welsh charmer at one of the conferences one year, and I believe him. But I think that it's one of those, it's very family tradition, very in, and of course people practicing things their grandparents did just because it's superstition or it's something lucky to do. So it's hard to say. It's hard to say if that's not a cop-out to say.
No, I know. And we do things, don't we, just because we're brought up with it. It's like a family tradition. My last guest, Caelan, was saying when you get a purse in Edinburgh, they have to, I can't remember what he called it, they have to put a coin in the purse for the baby, and that gives them luck throughout their life, and that's gorgeous. Them little bits of witchcraft I really love. Just tiny little things.
It's little things, right? Yeah. And it's sort of like when you see... Was that Caleb Turner? I like Caleb Turner. He's good. Yeah. We have it as part of a culture. We have it as part of a culture. Coming up to the new year, singing Auld Lang Syne, or we used to do this, and I think it's a very northern thing, going out the back door and coming in around to the front door.
Yeah.
It's a ritual. Yeah.
Yeah,
it's magic, if you look at it that way.
And don't do your laundry on New Year's Day. An excuse to get out and do it, Charles. And of course, we can't talk about magic and Wales without mentioning the goddess. Mm-hmm. Do you want to say it? How do you say it?
Yeah, Ceridwen. Yeah, Ceridwen.
Ceridwen. Yeah, because I'm Yorkshire, I can't say anything if it's...
Oh, I know. My accent, honestly, I have four different accents. I have a northern accent, I have a Welsh accent, I have a neutral British accent, and then a Canadian accent. I don't know where I am until I start speaking.
I can hear the Welsh Ceridwen, in this interview.
Ceridwen is an interesting character because... She shows up maybe in a lot of historical records. Christopher Hughes, who is the Anglesey Druid Order head, has done a wonderful, wonderful book looking at, okay, this black sow figure in this particular legend that's not connected to Mabinogi. And black sow, of course, is something that Ceridwen is associated with. It must be the same character, right? So you can see how over the centuries her character developed and became more and more. But she is connected to Llyn Tegid, Lake Bala in North Wales. And people go there all the time. There's a lot of Welsh practitioners go and lay offerings and do ritual there. I know Christopher Hughes does. And I still have to make pilgrimage there. I was so close. I was in Wrexham when I first came over. And I was so close, but we ended up not going. But I still have to make it over there. But she's a huge figure, and she's a huge figure because she's well known outside of Wales, particularly in neo-paganism. She became this really big central figure, and feel like a lot of people didn't really know what she was. Because again, people are relying on sources that have been created by other sources, but been written by people that weren't Welsh. And so now that we have a lot of really good, grounded Welsh writers putting information out there, I feel like this is the sense anyways, that she's becoming more well-known in that way. I like to think of her as the great catalyst. So she's very alchemical. She is, when you see the chase, so for those who don't know, the story is that she had a really ugly son, Morfran, and she wanted to give him as much as she could to give him a good head start in life. She knew that he wouldn't be beautiful, but she could give him wisdom and she could give him inspiration, and that would be valued.
Excuse my shoddy internet having a little paddy there.
Because in that society, he could become a bard, and a bard connected to the kings, or the princes, I should say. So she devised, so Ceridwen is the wife of the Lord of Tegid, who is, if we look at it, the god of that lake. His castle is supposed to be inside the lake itself, and so she is his consort. And so she gathered all of these herbs in order to start a brew that would take a year and a day to complete. And she found a boy and a blind man and set them to tending the fire for her as she went around and did her rituals and her gathering and continued to stoke the fire. And just as the year and the end day, just as the ending was coming, suddenly three drops of inspiration emerged out of the cauldron. Ceridwen's cauldron, and the boy, Gwion Bach, little Gwion, sucked his finger, and he ingested those three, the distillation of that year-long process. All of the other liquid turned into poison, which is an alchemical process, and then the cauldron burst. So Ceridwen was livid and chased him, but because he had ingested this magic, this inspiration, he was able to change his form, and so they chased each other around North Wales or around the area, and every time he changed into something, she changed into the other natural predator of that. He changed into a fish, she changed into an eagle. He changed into a corn of barley, she changed into a black hen, and then she ingested him. She held him inside, she became pregnant with him, and 9 months later he was reborn, and he went on to become the bard Taliesin. It really a powerful story. Yeah, she's great. She's really cool. And again, she's connected to the landscape. You can go to the lake that she did this in. And same with all of the other stories in this book. You can go to these places. They're not just somehow in the ether. They're in the landscape. So go there.
Do you work with her in your magic?
I do and I don't. It's one of those things. I have a court of spirits and deities that I work with. They tend to be ones that I see in my life. So like, Hermes is a really important one because he's Lord of Communication. Communication has been an issue in my life because of my accent, because of my dyspraxia. I had to go through speech therapy, being understood, but also in counseling, right? He's omnipresent. Same with Weird, this idea of working with Weird, as I was saying before, right? Really identifying it in my life and seeing how it has affected me, and I start to work with it and start to connect with it. Ceridwen I have worked with before, but it's not as strong, and yeah, it's convoluted. But she is a powerful spirit. She's certainly a spirit that is very present in Wales. Because I'm in Northamptonshire, it's a little different down here. It freaked me out when I was starting to connect with the spirits of this landscape, because I try to work with the spirits of whatever landscape I'm in. It feels appreciable, it feels respectful, but sometimes it can be a little freaky because it doesn't feel like there is anything here. In Northamptonshire here, I freaked out when I first moved here because the landscape felt to me very dead. It felt like nothing was going on. And what I came to realize is actually the whole landscape here is the landscape of a crossroads, because it is the Midlands and people have to move through Northamptonshire particularly in order to get up to the north, get over to East Anglia, go over to Wales, right, Birmingham. And so it is literally the crossroads, and I've always been at the crossroads in my life. So of course it was a familiar feeling. It wasn't what I was expecting. So that's how I try to work. So with Ceridwen, because I haven't been there yet, she's very theoretical to me. I think when I actually go there and experience and lay my head down to the earth and abase myself, I think I'll see if that's something if I get a calling to work that. Yeah. Oh, that makes sense. I feel like
it
I just
did.
Went on and on.
No,
there. Yeah,
it's
okay.
Good as that. It's amazing, because I agree as well. I do feel the same.
It is. It's a very weird zone because it's, as I said, crossroads, and that web of fate, literally the web of destiny, is really something that I've worked a lot with, and it's very familiar. So it caught me off guard when I came here, and it felt so familiar, even though I'd never been here before. It's a very different energy from, say, going up north. A couple of months ago, I went to visit Knaresborough, and of course, stopped off to say hello to our lovely Mother Shipton, right? I went to Wales, and there's an energy of Wales. I went to Glastonbury a month ago, and there's an energy to Glastonbury. I'm not sure what kind of energy it is, but it's an energy, right? But here, it's just, again, it was that familiar feeling, and it caught me off guard, because I was like, really? But now I'm here, now it makes sense, and the spirits here are of that crossroads, and so it feels empowering being in this landscape.
Are you staying there? Are you going to go back to Wales?
I'm going to stay here. Yeah, I'm going to stay here. It would be a long journey for me to get to places like Treadwells. I just went into a talk at Treadwells last week, and there's a lot more opportunity for me, at least now, to go and do stuff. I wanted to be in a place where I could have a good radius because of my work and because of my research. I want to have access to those places. It makes sense to be in at least, not maybe exactly where I am now, but within the radius of this area. But I did, when I came up to Leeds, I did love Leeds. It's just so expensive.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. Lovely. Yeah. Can you tell my listener where we can find you?
So you can find everything on benstimpson.com. You can find me on YouTube, Instagram, Facebook, really at Ben Stimpson Author. And I've got my podcast on there. I do have a load of my talks on there too. So the Treadwells talk is on there as well. And yeah, you can find my books online. You can find it at the History Press or my First Llewellyn book online at any of the retailers that you can buy books from. Also, go to your local bookshop and order through them. They can usually get it too. So yeah, you can find me. Reach out if you have any questions or any interesting facts you want to share. And I look forward to it.
And what's your podcast called?
Essence Podcast with Ben Stimson. So Ooh. I've had people like Dave Vibard has been on there. I've had Matt Oren. I've had Laura Tempest-Zakroff, Amy Blackthorne. A lot of the North American ones are on there. And so I'm going to be revamping that and starting to speak to UK practitioners. So I'd love to have you on if you'd be interested. It would be a joy to have another conversation with you.
Thank you very much.
And put you in the hot seat.
Oh, God. I'm not that brainy. Like, when I get on the spot, my brain just goes, whee, and there's nothing in there.
Oh, it's all good.
It's like tumbleweeds. You mentioned books as well, so you got two books. So we what's the other book before we let you go?
The other book it's called Ancestral Whispers, A Guide to Developing Ancestral Veneration Practices. A very different type of book. This is through Llewellyn Worldwide, and it is a guide to developing ancestral practice. So one of the practices I was connected with, as I said, was Sakumi, an Orisha practice from West Africa based in Cuba, and a huge part of that is working with the ancestors. And when I started to work with my own British ancestors, I saw that there was not really anything written out there that didn't come from a practice already. So there are a lot of books, but it's like, how do you do ancestor veneration in Chinese tradition? How do you do ancestor veneration in Hoodoo? How do you do veneration in, right? So this book is a guidebook to developing your own practice with your own spirits, your own ancestors, regardless of who you are. And it's really it's almost like a therapy session between you and your ancestors. I was quite proud of it. It came out about, 2 years ago now, something like that. And I'm still quite proud of it. It's my baby. It's my firstborn. I bully it as much as I can, but it's good.
I need to get that in my vast collection. Yeah.
I have no idea what you mean. I can tell.
Ben's got a massive bookcase absolutely full to the brim of books, which mine's there. It's not quite as impressive.
It's pretty good going, though. Yeah, it's very aesthetic.
I know. I've got a pile next to my bed, which ain't so aesthetic. It's like a tower. Anything else you'd like to add?
This book, as we talked about, this book and the sequels eventually when they come out, is designed for people to actually go to the places. I've tried to include as many of the actual physical stuff that people can go and visit in the book. And it's designed really so that people can take detours, or if they're going to Wales for a weekend, and particularly for people in Wales, to go to other parts of Wales to go and uncover these stories, because witches and the witch ancestors are all around us. We may just not know about them because they haven't been written. Stuff hasn't been collected. If you buy the book, go to the places, imagine you're in the story itself and connect and commune. That's really what one of my big goals was, for people to actually visit the country, because it is one of the best countries in the world. I'm a little biased, but it is one of the most beautiful, in my opinion. And I loved it. And yeah, for 30 years, I had massive hiv. And so now I'm over here with this handy guidebook that I've done. I've got places I need to go. Yeah, that's what I would add. Thank you for having me on. It was wonderful talking to you today.
Could you say something like, I don't know, a sentence in Welsh? It'd be great to finish the podcast with something like that.
Dwi ddim siarad Cymraeg, dwi'n dysgu Cymraeg. So I don't speak Welsh, but I'm learning Welsh. Right. Thank you. Diolch yn fawr iawn. Thank you.
You have been listening to the Bellwitch podcast, created with love and magic by me, Swales, the friendly green witch. Big thank you to my lovely guest for this episode. And thank you to you, dear listener, for choosing the Bellwitch podcast to fill your ears. If you have a witch business, an independent podcast, a witchy topic you'd like me to talk about, or a trailer you'd like me to play, reach me on the Bellwitch podcast at yahoo.com. I love to hear from you, and I love to support you, and I love to celebrate other witch businesses, because there indeed is magic in sharing audiences amongst podcasts and other spiritual businesses. If you would like to show the Bellwitch podcast some love, you can leave ratings and reviews wherever you listen to your podcasts, as those stars really do help the show to shine. Join the Bellwitch podcast on Patreon for bonus content, early access, and behind-the-scene videos. Until next time, stay magical, witches. By bell, by grave, by candle's flame, beauty is bound, cruelty slain. This is V Cosmetics. Vegan, occult, and always witchcrafted. Use the code BELLWITCH at vecosmetics.com to claim your power.
Hi, Uncle Laser here. America's built on fast cars, fast food, and even faster women. Photo Casino's built in America. You know what they're fast at? Fast cash prize redemption. You see, only Moto is U.S. owned and operated. Moto, it's American made. That's who we are, and that's who we care about. Play for free at Moto.us.
Moto Casino's the social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details. Must be 21 plus.
Moto Casino, America's social casino.